Working as a journalist for a decade, Jennifer Weiner became a best-selling novelist, writing with her now characteristic wit about the tangled and intimate relationships between women. Her new book, Then Came You, explores surrogacy and family from four different vantage points. India yearns to have a child with her wealthy new husband and hires a surrogate. Her stepdaughter, Bettina, thinks India's a gold digger and is determined to dig up secrets from her stepmother's past. Jules is a Princeton student who sells her high-grade eggs to raise money to help her dad. And Annie is a housewife and becomes a surrogate, using Jules' eggs to help her families that her family that's struggling financially. Jennifer Weiner has written now 9 books. She also has a TV show that she co-created and is the executive producer of. It's on the ABC Family Comedy Channel, and it's called State of Georgia. Jennifer Weiner joining us once again on Radio Times, and nice to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Are you enjoying your success?
I'm enjoying. You know, what they say is that writing is hell, but having written is heaven. Yes. So I'm enjoying having written and having produced.
Well, I notice on your new book that your name is bigger than your title.
Oh, God. I have nothing to do with that.
I know that.
Not
but,
me.
But that doesn't that tell us something about you?
How
you're perceived?
It's all about the brand, I guess. And, God, I kick myself for not having changed my name when I had a chance. It's terrible.
Is that true?
Yeah, you know, I was 31 when my first book was published, and I figured I'd been a journalist for 10 years, and maybe people knew my byline, and there was some recognition factor there, but, like, God, like, the whiny Jennifer Weiner joke is just too, it's too easy.
Do you have a better name that if you could roll back
God,
the clock?
It would be Jennifer Aronson, because that double A, I'd be at the top of everybody's alphabetized piles, you know, like.
And then you're at the bottom, right?
I'm at the bottom. It's so sad.
So where did this story come from? This story, yes, that looks at surrogacy from these four perspectives.
Well, Then Came You was born in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. There was a story, I think in 2008, and it was called My Baby, Her Body. And it was about a woman who was my age almost exactly, who was struggling to stay pregnant. She could get pregnant but couldn't sort of maintain a pregnancy. Older husband, had 4 adult children, really, really, really wanted a baby, and decided to do the modern thing. And so it was her eggs, his sperm, and a gestational surrogate from Pennsylvania. And the thing that people remember from this piece were the pictures, because there was a shot of the woman who's the biological mom, I guess, her egg, standing in front of her estate at the Hamptons, holding the baby with a uniformed African-American nanny standing behind her. Ouch.
Ouch.
And then a photo of the gestational surrogate, which is what they call the woman who actually carries the child, who was literally barefoot and pregnant in the picture. And the iconography said so much about class, about money, about the economics of who gets what they want reproductively in America. And I just thought, God, there's a story here. And so that's what I wrote.
But as a mom yourself, did you also sort of relate to the, first of all, the desire to have a child, and then the sometimes complicating factors of actually having that child?
It's interesting. I mean, I was never one of these women who was just like, I must have a baby. It will be the only thing that completes me. Certainly, I know people like that. You know, I figured if it never happened for me, I would have found another way somehow, or I would have been okay with it. But I definitely, the idea of a baby as like status to be obtained, right, that interested me a lot. And the idea of the baby as sort of this thing that completes a marriage, this sort of token of, you know, that this will last forever. I was interested in that, and certainly I'm always interested in the way women relate to each other, and it just seemed such a fraught idea where there's the exchange of money, there's the exchange of genetic material, there's admissions of weakness and incapability, you know, sort of a wealthy woman who can't do something and a poor woman who's being paid to do it. There was just so much there to unpack.
Well, and it seems for anyone that has a child or is a surrogate or even donates eggs,
yes,
there is that wistfulness of looking around the world and wondering.
Yeah.
You see a child with a mom or a dad, and
yep,
you think, is that my child?
Well, it's so interesting. The Times ran a story a couple weeks ago about sperm donors discovering that they have 150 kids running around out there, and that they were promised by sperm banks, you know, oh, it'll be 6, it'll be a dozen tops, and that it's 150 kids that you're biologically related to, you know. And then there was a story, Lisa Belkin, who runs the Motherload blog at the Times, found a woman who donated her eggs and sort of asked her. And it seems that there is, it's not like giving a baby up for adoption, but it's not like donating sperm. It's something different. And we don't know yet enough of what it's going to be like for those kids, what it's going to be like for those women. You know, 20 years down the road, is, are you going to be, you know, if you've donated eggs, are you going to be looking at children on the street and thinking, you know, and if you're a child who came into the world this way, what does that leave you with? Lots of
questions.
Big questions, yeah.
Well, speaking of donating eggs, I'd love to have you say, read a section from the book. And as I should say to our listeners, it's written from four different vantage points. And this is Jules, yes. the Princeton student.
Yes, Jules is in the mall where she goes because it feels more like home to her than the campus. And she's eating in the food court. The man sat down uninvited. "Are you 21? I narrowed my eyes, one hand on the strap of my backpack, wondering whether he was going to propose something illegal or seamy, like phone sex or stripping. Up close, he was older than I thought, older than he should have been if he was hitting on a girl my age, maybe 45, with a plain gold wedding band on his left hand, and I didn't want to have dinner with him, or give him my number, or my email address, or tell him where I lived, or let him buy me a drink or a frozen yogurt. I just wanted to finish my food and go back to my dorm room, avoid my boyfriend, curl up with a book, and count the days until graduation." That was when he smiled. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'm getting ahead of myself." "Jared Baker," he said, and stuck his hand across the table. I shook it quickly. The skin of his palm felt as soft as I imagined the skin on his face would. I got to my feet, never mind that half my dinner was still sitting there. "Excuse me, but my friends are probably waiting for me." I had my tray in one hand and my backpack in the other when Jared Baker said, "How would you like to make $20,000? My skin was tingling. Illegal, I thought. Has to be. Doing what? Smuggling drugs out of Mexico? His smile widened so that I could see his teeth. "Egg donation." I set my tray back on the table. "Sit," said Jared Baker, coming around to pull my chair out for me. He looped my backpack straps over the chair and did everything but spread a paper napkin in my lap. It was a funny performance, like a parody of a man tending to a wife who was fragile as an egg, or who was carrying fragile eggs. "Eat your dinner," he frowned at the plate. "Skip the spring roll, though. Saturated fats." Looking him right in the eye, I dragged the roll through the slurry of Chinese mustard and duck sauce I'd made and took a giant bite. His grin widened. "Moxie," he said. "That's nice. People like a girl with a sense of humor." "Are you serious?" I asked once I'd swallowed $20,000 for an egg. I'd seen ads, of course, in the school paper, online and on flyers posted in the student union in the library, families seeking egg donors, all expenses paid, please help make our dreams come true. But I'd never noticed the fee for the eggs itself, and I'd never guessed it would be so high.
And again, Jennifer Weiner reading from her new novel called Then Came You. I mean, that's such a seduction slash flirtation,
sure,
right,
yes.
over her eggs, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was fun to write because, you know, the book starts with her noticing this man, noticing her, and you wonder, is he stalking her? Is he going to be hitting on her? What's going on? And then I liked the twist of the what he wants is...
Yes, exactly. He wants her eggs.
He wants her eggs, yeah.
And she's attractive. I mean, she's the kind of attractive person where her father says to her...
Boys are going to look at you.
They're going to look at you.
No, and it was interesting because, you know, I read a lot, lots of blogs and message boards and sort of how women go about choosing who they want to donate the eggs. And it's actually a very... I think a very similar process to men picking women on online dating sites. Like, you want tall, blonde, and busty. You know, you want that sort of ideal. You want that kind of the girl we all want to look like.
And you also want someone who might be an Ivy League graduate.
Smart.
Genius eggs.
Absolutely.
On top of that.
Absolutely. Like, if you're going to be paying top dollar, you want top quality.
Well, and I should say you are a Princeton grad yourself.
I don't think anybody want my eggs. What's left of them?
But there's one line in here and where she's kind of looking at her fellow students and she says, you know, Princeton, where everyone looks like they never have any doubts.
Yeah.
Was that your impression?
Yeah, it was. You know, and I think everybody was full of doubts. I just wasn't able to suss that out at the time. But, you know, I think that a lot of people at those colleges go through their 4 years feeling like they were the admissions department's big mistake. And, like, you have to just, like, study really hard or you're going to be found out and kicked out and, like, have to go home.
An imposter, maybe.
Yes, exactly. I think everybody feels like a fake at those places.
But some, I guess, are better than faking than others.
Yeah, and probably there are some people who just don't think about it at all. I felt like a fake.
Did you?
I did, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You did pretty well there.
Yeah,
though, right?
I know. I did. I studied way too hard. I did not have enough fun.
Was it fun, though, to create Jules?
Yes. Yes. Definitely. I think she's probably the best looking person I've ever written about. And that was really interesting to sort of... imagine what it's like to go through the world looking unassailable the way that she does.
Yeah.
And then I made her gay to sort of undercut the
whole
thing.
I was going to say.
I just always have to mess with it, don't I? I can't just let it be.
But was that one of those sort of aha moments as a writer, or just she sort of evolved into a lesbian as you were writing about her?
I don't know if she evolved into a lesbian or she always was one.
Exactly.
No, it was one of those things that surprised me. Like, I knew she was a girl who was not comfortable in her own skin in spite of all this beauty, right? And I figured a lot of it had to do with the family secret. Her father's an addict, and that's what we learn in the course of the story. She's going to take this money that she's going to get from selling her eggs and try to get him back into rehab.
Which is a noble thing to do.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's the thing. It's like everybody's got the best of intentions and the worst of intentions, too, with the whole project of making this baby, the baby of this book. You know, you've got India, whose name is not really India, who, you know, she wants to sort of cement her marriage, but she does not really want a baby. And she's pretty straight up about that. She ends up loving the baby, which I had, you know, I imagine would happen in the best case scenario. But I mean, she wants this child more for what it's going to represent than who it's going to be. You know, and then there's Annie, the gestational surrogate, who's, I mean, she's thinks of herself as a prostitute at one point. You know, mm-hmm. She is selling her body to make money for her family.
And her family does not support this idea.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was really interesting for me because I thought so much about how husbands must feel watching their wives being pregnant and having to say, no, it's not mine. It's not ours. She's giving that baby away. That has to be weird, doesn't it?
Oh, I would imagine so. And this is a family that needs money.
That needs money.
Like a lot of families in this country.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things I found in my research is it's a lot of military women who do this while their husbands are deployed. Yes, the husbands don't have to see it. They're overseas.
Do they know about it?
Oh, yeah, they know about it. But and also, military medical insurance covers pregnancies and doesn't ask a lot of questions. So that's a really good way. These women have medical coverage. They can have all the expenses of the pregnancy taken care of. And nobody really says, well, is this your husband's or are you doing this to make money? People kind of look the other way, you know, and I said it in the book, like they know how hard soldiers work. They're not paid a ton of money. And they're thinking, OK, this is a way to sort of help these families.
And the family, and in this case, the wife helping the family, they need her money.
They need her money, yeah. You know, and she gets sort of judged. You know, there's sort of the religious talk about, like, you know, did God really intend for things to work this way? Did God intend for this woman to have a baby? She's bought an egg. She's rented someone else's body. Her husband is maybe a little older than he should be to be bringing a new baby into the world. Lots of questions.
Lots of questions and more answers after this very short break. Jennifer Weiner, our guest today on Radio Times. Her ninth novel has been published and it's called Then Came You. And it looks at surrogacy from the relationship between four women. And we're going to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Opera Company of Philadelphia launches a new season with Carmen, running in five performances September 30th through October 14th at the Academy of Music. This classic production features Renat Shahan in the title role, with an opening night simulcast live on Independence Mall. Information on Carmen at operaphila.org or 215-893-1018. The Opera Company of Philadelphia is proud to support WHYY.
It's back to school time, and that means homework. It's a hugely pesky topic for many families, but it doesn't have to ruin your evenings and weekends. I'm Mike and Scott. Join us on September 13th for the first event in our new WHYY parenting series. Experts, educators, and parents will develop strategies for kids and families to get homework done. September 13th at 6:30 p.m. here at WHYY. To register, visit whyy.org/member experience.
It's almost a cliche that girls need good friends to be happy, healthy, and whole, but what about boys? The moms have already weighed in on a new book that reports on 20 years of research about what boys want and need in friendships. Now we hear from the dads. It's our weekly parenting conversation, and it's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with novelist and Philadelphian Jennifer Weiner. Her ninth book, Then Came You, has just been published. And it's a story of four women who come together over issues of egg donorship, surrogacy, motherhood, and class. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. One of the other women that we haven't really talked about is Bettina. So this is India's stepdaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And India married her father, obviously,
mm-hmm.
and he's very wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And Bettina sees him as a gold digger. I think she even uses those
mm-hmm.
words.
Yeah.
She does not trust this woman.
No, no. She is deeply suspicious, and it turns out has a right to be, because India is lying about just about everything, starting with her name and moving on to her age and her whole life story. You know, but Bettina was interesting, too, because if you think about this whole, if you think about Then Came You as a story about yearning for family and yearning for completion, Bettina's parents are divorced. Her mom has sort of ditched the whole New York lifestyle. She's moved to an ashram, which was lots of fun to write about.
I bet.
Yes. And Bettina wants her mom and dad to get back together. And she knows that this isn't realistic. She knows this is sort of a silly and sad thing to yearn for at her age. But she can't stand the idea that when her father marries this woman, it means one thing. But if they have a baby together, it means something else. It means that door has closed. And she is desperate to prevent that door from closing. And so she sort of investigates her stepmother.
Indeed, she does. And one thing we learn about India, her stepmother, is that she had she spent a lot of money on plastic surgery and sort of completely sort of remaking this new self.
Yeah, that being in LA thing.
Well, I was wondering about that.
I mean, it's interesting. You know, I think Heidi Montag, that's the reality starlet who had like the 9 hours of plastic surgery and was all over People magazine and basically turned herself into someone different. And you see a lot of that these days.
Especially out in LA.
Especially out in LA, where they all seem to be turning themselves into the same person, which is a little alarming. Like there's armies of them out there. But no, I mean, I was interested in the notion of transformation and in the idea of like, can you ever really become somebody else, or are you always sort of tethered to your history?
Well, I was thinking she reminds me, although as I get to know India, I see that she's different from the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, mm-hmm. one can see that type.
That type. Yes.
Yes.
And I think that she aspires to that, which is interesting. I think that most of us watch those shows for entertainment and not aspiration. Like you sort of want to see that these beautiful people have lives just as messed up as anybody else. But I think to India, these are women who have made it and they look the way they should.
You write, using new credit cards, not letting myself think about how I pay off the balances. I had my hair color switched from blonde to rich, glossy chestnut, shot through with strands of copper and gold. A little liposuction came next because no matter how hard I work, I'd never be able to rid myself of the jiggle of my inner thighs. And you mm-hmm. go on. I mean, she's mm-hmm. sort of dissecting her
yes.
body
uh-huh.
obsessively.
Well, I think that she recognizes that her body's her commodity. This is her stock in the marketplace. Her face and her figure are what she's going to use to get her, to leverage herself to the next plane of being. And she treats her body like, you know, like it's a car to be maintained and detailed and improved upon. And I've actually in LA, I've heard breast implants referred to as, I think, aftermarket improvements.
Like, no.
Like when you go get a car and then you go like add a spoiler, that's like an aftermarket thing. Like that implants are aftermarket things. So I think that that's how India sees it. Yeah.
Was she an interesting character to write about? In that mm-hmm. one, you know, first impression is that she's this
cold, horrible,
shallow gold digger.
Exactly. And then it was, okay, you know, you can start with a woman like that, and it's a question of how did she get there? And so investigating her history, she'd been abandoned by her mom. You know, mom got pregnant as a teenager, sort of ditched her with the grandparents and went off to follow the Grateful Dead. You know, sort of spent her whole life feeling unwanted, had a very unhappy and brief reunion with her mother, and then married an older man, married her teacher, and was living with him, got pregnant, freaked out, took off, went to Los Angeles, and turned herself into somebody different.
Mm.
So I think at the end, India emerges as kind of a sympathetic person. I guess, you know, maybe even if you asked Heidi Montag, why are you doing all of this to yourself? Maybe there'd be a sympathetic story there.
Oh, interesting. I mean, yeah. Were you interested in trying to humanize somebody
that? Exactly. Like, just wondering why, you know, because it's so antithetical to anything I'd ever do. I guess it's always a question of, like, you know, who are you and how did you get this way?
Right.
The big novelist question.
But I also wonder, and I don't want to make too much of it, but it looks like in this book that parents are a disappointment. Mm. I mean, we have...
I'm preparing my children.
There. as a parent myself.
It's going to suck.
It is. But you've got Jules, whose mm-hmm. dad is troubled,
yep.
has an alcoholic problem or certainly an addiction problem.
Drug issues.
Mm-hmm. Her mom disappears into an ashram and is kind of selfish.
Uh-huh.
And you've got India, who's got family problems herself as well.
Uh-huh.
Are you stealing yourself?
Oh, or? God. Well, look, you know, I can give this book to my daughter someday and be like, see, it could have been worse. Okay. Did I go to an ashram? No. Did I change my entire appearance? No. See, it's all fine. You know, I think from a perspective of fiction, you can't have people be too happy. It just ruins everything. Like, you know, unhappy families are all different, but happy families are all boring. But it's interesting. I mean, I think that to be an adult is to be disappointed, you know, and it's so funny. The book
in a lot of things,
in a lot of things. And, you know, to realize that things aren't perfect, that your parents weren't perfect, that their marriage wasn't perfect, that nothing, that there is no perfection. There is only striving. But I know, but it's interesting. The book I'm working on now, there's a 48-year-old woman who she's been adopted, and her adoptive parents have just told her that the whole story of how she was adopted was a lie. And right. So she's, you know, she was always told it was like a, you know, some teenager who gave birth and that was her mom. And it turns out the mom is someone these people knew and have known their whole life. And she's thinking, okay, well, it's just tacky to be angry at your parents when you're 48 years old. Like, at some point, you just got to let it go. So there we are.
You said you enjoyed writing about an ashram.
Yes.
I mean, with some degree of snark and smirk.
A little bit, yeah. Tartness, I would say. You know, I mean, it's so easy to make fun of those places. It's just, there's and in L.A., like, that's the thing. The book I'm working on now is set in L.A., and you have to be careful because it's just very, very easy to, like, just take, like, the same easy cheap shots at the culture and the industry that everybody does. So it's interesting. One of the characters in that book is a standards and practices lawyer, and I had a lot of dealings with the standards and practices people. They're the ones who send you notes on your scripts and say things like, if you're going to have a goat in the bee scene, we need a representative from the Humane Society on the set to make sure that the care of the goat is compliant with, you know, and sort of scrutinize every word. And they're like, you know, this joke about Barbara Streisand just isn't going to work because she's notoriously litigious and it's not even that funny. And so then you have to, like, make the joke about Hillary Clinton hoping she won't sue. Yeah, so I'm trying to make the standards and practices lawyer a sympathetic character.
But going back to this ashram, do you have a little dig in here about Eat, Pray, Love?
No, I loved Eat, Pray, Love.
Okay.
No, it's just I went to Canyon Ranch and thought it was a little silly.
Oh.
I loved it, but it was just like the whole sort of, like, you know, enlightenment is yours for $10,000 a weekend. It's like, really? I don't know about this.
It all comes back to money.
But I liked Eat. I am an Eat, Pray, Love supporter. I am not in the backlash on that one. No.
And that's Jennifer Weiner, our guest today on Radio Times.
Hello.
She has worked as a journalist. In fact, was a journalist here at the Philadelphia Inquirer for
In the day.
Uh-huh. For a number of years. And she's just written her ninth book. It's called Then Came You. Her first novel, Good in Bed, was a bestseller. In Her Shoes was made into a movie starring Cameron Diaz. And Jennifer Weiner is now the co-creator and executive producer of the new ABC Family comedy called State of Georgia. And a little bit later in the show, we do want to play a clip from that as well.
Awesome.
And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. This seems like an issue that has followed you and me around because we have talked about this before. And this is this whole sort of chick lit. I don't even like that word anymore.
I don't either.
But you've been in the thick of it. There was a sort of a back and forth with Jonathan Franzen.
Uh-huh.
And then Jennifer Egan seemed to make a crack about women, writers who write popular books.
Uh-huh.
Why do you think I don't know if this is going to haunt you for the rest of your life, but why do you think we can't resolve this popular book?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think that there are still really pervasive and deep-seated double standards that suggest that women's work is worth less, matters less, is valued less than men's work. I think that there is a thing among quote-unquote literary women novelists where they feel that they have to distance themselves from their best-selling sisters and sort of say, I'm not doing that. I don't like that. I don't read that. I don't write that. I'm not that. I'm with them, you know, pointing at the Jonathan Franzens and Jonathan Safran Foers of the world, which is disappointing because, you know, as a writer, but as a reader, like, I'm a huge fan of literary fiction, of women's literary fiction. And it bothers me when they're like, I'm not that. I don't like her. It's, you know, I think it's really counterproductive because women writers are not the ones making the decisions about what's getting reviewed in The New Yorker, what's getting covered in The New York Times. And it's very frustrating where you look at the coverage that somebody like Tom Parada gets, where the Times reviewed his book twice. They published a profile of him the day the book came out. They published excerpts of the profile of him a week later in the book review, and they did a podcast about him. And then you look at, you know, sort of whoever you want to pick as being sort of comparable to him. I don't know, you know, if it's somebody like Alice Hoffman who's doing domestic stuff, or Mona Simpson, or Laurie Moore, and maybe, you know, maybe there'll be one review. Maybe there will be a profile. Probably the profile will be in the style section, not in the arts section. You know, and that's kind of all they get. And it's like, well, why? Like, why are there four pieces about this guy writer and two about this woman, or none about this woman? And it's just, I don't get it. It's frustrating to me, not as a writer so much. Like, everybody's like, oh, she just wants them to cover her books. And I would like that, sure, but I don't think it's ever going to happen. And I've somehow managed to make my way as a novelist without the Times covering my books. But I think they should be fair. I think they should be fair to women writers. I think that there are a lot of books out there, and it's very frustrating when they keep covering the same one over and over and over again. I wish things would change. There's a new editor at the Times. They've got their first woman executive editor ever. I'd like to. Yeah, Jill Abramson. I'd like to think things are going to change over there. I'm not optimistic that they will. I mean, I think it's one of these things that, like, it'll happen incrementally and probably not in my lifetime. But God, if my daughters end up writers, I hope they're not fighting these battles of, like, it's not chick lit. It's just a book. Could you just cover it like a book? Like, please.
Well, I noticed you did get a nice review in the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. I realize it's not the New York Times. I mean, do you feel like
it really is.
Well, the bit that you focused your site on this newspaper.
I think that they set the tone. I mean, very few papers have freestanding book sections left. I think there's two. And I think that as the Times goes, so goes the rest of book coverage. I do think that if they decide that, like, this new, like the Chad Harbach book, The Art of Fielding, if they decide that's a big deal, then everybody else, every other paper, every other outlet, every other blog has to be like, okay, should we be covering this too? Probably we should cover it. Maybe we should. So I think that they're important just because it's sort of top-down effect. Like, when they write 12 articles about Jonathan Franzen's new book and, like, two about the George R.R. Martin, the new Game of Thrones book, which has been, like, on the very top of the bestseller list all summer long and has gotten, I think, like, one review and one article. It's like they really sort of disdain popular stuff. They don't care about the books that people really are reading. And that's especially true of women. Like, I think they had to review the Martin book because men read that, you know. But, like, I think that, you know, the Suki Stackhouse stuff, the Charlaine Harrison, like, they won't touch it.
But is being a bestseller, I mean, does that feel like second prize?
A little bit, you know.
Doesn't feel like you've won this competition or this race?
I don't know. I don't like to think of it as a competition or a race. I mean, I like to think that it's all about finding readers and finding a home for your work in the world. And I think certainly you don't need the Times to do that. You can do that through word of mouth. You can do it bottom up instead of top down. But I just think that it's strange that sort of the quote-unquote paper of record is so out of touch with what women are reading and the books that they care about, because they review movies and music and television shows like very ecumenically. Like State of Georgia got a great review in the New York Times, like, and it's on ABC Family, and it's for like young girls, and they loved it. But with books, it's like there's this very narrow focus. It's like if the film critics only reviewed art house films, if they ignored sort of romantic comedies and sort of said, you know, women watch them, we don't care. It's weird.
Interesting. I mean, I can see the passion in your. No, it's. I'm not trying to embarrass you here.
It is embarrassing. I wish. I mean, there's a lot of chick lit writers, quote unquote chick lit writers, who just will not engage with this. They're just like, yeah, you know, it'd be nice if it was different. Don't really care. Right. Here's my dress, and we'll post a picture of a dress, and it's like, I wish. Yeah. I don't know why this. It's my thing. I don't know.
Well, and interestingly, when Jennifer Egan, I mean, she's an award winning writer, mm-hmm. and she did make this sort of crack about mm-hmm. about popular writers.
Shoot higher,
exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then she apologized. So we must give her that. She sort of said, like, you know, there's a time and a place to sort of talk about what books matter and how they're covered, but that wasn't it. And I agree with her. I mean, I think it's tacky, dare I say, when you've won a Pulitzer, to use that occasion to criticize women who've been plagiarized already. It's like, God, they didn't suffer enough. You know, now we've got, you know, the Pulitzer Prize winner telling them that their books weren't even good enough to be ripped off. Thanks.
Well, and what she was referring to was a Harvard student who mm-hmm. had gotten found out for plagiarizing something, and instead of plagiarizing some sort of high lit thing,
she plagiarized. It was like, plagiarism's okay if you're ripping off quality stuff. That's good to know. Yeah. Thanks.
But and I don't want to make too much of this, but you write a lot about women and the mm-hmm. relationship between women, and mm-hmm. we know that women are not necessarily nice to each other.
This is true.
but do you think there is a sort of female
us and them
friction thing?
I wish there wasn't. I mean, there was an anthology published years ago called This Is Not Chick Lit, and like Francine Prose was one of the people who was in it, and I was like, really, Francine? Like, are people confused about what you're doing? Like, has anybody returned one of your books and said, sorry, not enough sex and shopping, want my money back? It's like, why you gotta hate on a sister? You know, that's how I feel. I think that we know statistically women get reviewed less. We know statistically women are published less frequently in the journals that matter. We know that in 2010, of the people who got reviewed twice in the Times, 82% of them were men. Okay. Given all we know, it seems that women ought to be supporting each other and recognizing that we are not the enemy. Like, I am not the enemy of some literary writer. You know, and I would hope that literary writers would not be the enemies of commercial, you know, successful, best-selling women. I think that we need each other at this moment in history.
And we're up on a break here. My first question to you was, do you feel like a success? No, I'll ask
That's
you that at
one.
The
yeah.
very end of the show.
Okay.
Jennifer Weiner, our guest today on Radio Times, talking about a whole bunch of things, including her new novel called Then Came You. She is also the co-creator and executive producer of a show on ABC Family Comedy called State of Georgia. And we do want to hear what our listeners have to say. What do you think? What do you read? And what do you think about this whole chick lit business? 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
People's Light and Theater supports WHYY and presents The Return of Don Quixote, September 21st through October 16th. Don Quixote is shaken from his boring yet respectable retirement when his old companion Sancho Panza shows up with an unauthorized biography that makes a mockery of their past escapades. What else can the friends do but hit the road again? A charming tale to remind us that romance and adventure hide around every corner, if we are brave enough to look. For information, 610-644-3500 or peopleslight.org.
On The Next Fresh Air, former FBI agent Ali Soufan talks about his experiences interrogating Islamist terrorists. He got Abu Zubaydah to identify Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the mastermind of 9/11. But then the interrogation was taken over by the CIA and Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded. Soufan's new book is called The Black Banners. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The Norway attacker brought attention to Norway's prison system, which has a much lower recidivism rate, but is it too much like a country club? Also, the Republican debates, is it really a two-man race? That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jennifer Weiner. She began her journalism career as a reporter for the Center Daily Times in State College, Pennsylvania.
Yes, you haven't heard of it.
But then she was hired by the Philadelphia Inquirer. Her first novel, Good in Bed, was a bestseller. Her second novel, In Her Shoes, was made into a movie. She's written other popular books, is co-creator and executive producer of the ABC show State of Georgia, which had its debut in the summer. And her new novel, Then Came You, was published this summer as well, explores surrogacy and family through the lives of four women. And Jennifer Weiner are joining us today on Radio Times talking about a whole bunch of stuff. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Have you written in this novel, Jules has a roommate who's a kind of a girlfriend, I would say,
mm-hmm.
And they have sex. And
yep.
Have you written sex scenes before?
Oh, yes. I this was my first same-sex sex scene.
There you go.
Big milestone. Yeah.
Did it feel like a big milestone?
It did. You know, it's it's always interesting to write sex scenes when your parents are not both dead. And my mom is in a relationship with a woman now, so like there was a lot of pressure to get it right.
Did you ask them anything?
No, God, no. I mean, it's funny. I have a friend who's a writer, and we always joke about like sending our siblings and our parents sort of the redacted versions of our books with all that stuff crossed out and be like, nothing to see here. Just move along, move along. It's weird. Because I feel like when you're writing about sex, the people close to you think maybe you've had it. And then it's just unpleasant.
Which is probably, I mean, all novels, and as someone who interviews novelists, you look for what you think are sort of bits and pieces of the novelist there.
Uh-huh.
And it seems that when it gets to sex, as a reader or interviewer, you figure they might be telling us something about them, something really intimate about themselves.
Yes, and with your parents, like them, or your brothers, the most intimate thing I want them to know about me is like how I want my eggs in the morning or something like that. So, eggs, we're back to eggs.
So, what do they have? They talked to you about these?
No. My mom, like the most I ever get out of her is like, it's such a page turner. And I'm like, thanks, you know, and my brothers are like, good book. But no, nobody has, I have not heard anything about that sex scene. I was very proud of it, I have to say.
Well, I thought it was very well done,
Thank you.
To be honest with you.
Yeah, you know, it was sort of it was a first-time sex scene, you know, like the first time these two people are together, and there's all the dynamic that goes along with that. But no, it's, writing about sex is not one of the easy things that writers do.
Yeah, and because I guess there is potentially a self-consciousness about it.
Yes, and then there's just the language. You know, like what do you call the bits and pieces? What words can you use that aren't jokes or aren't sort of, you know, throbbing members from romance novels? You know, it's like, what do you call it? I don't know. Tough.
What did you call it?
Well, there wasn't a throbbing member. That's the beauty of writing about women. There's no throbbing members you have to deal with. I don't know. But no, I mean, I really, really, really struggled with... I don't know if I can say what I called it on the radio, but it was tough.
Yeah.
It was hard.
Yeah. Let me get a couple of callers in, and then I do want to talk about your
my
work,
TV, yes,
your TV
my,
and
my
your
other
work
my night job.
Exactly. Yeah. Let me get looks like Leslie from Mount Laurel to join us. And Leslie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. I just wanted to call in for the first time to tell Ms. Weiner that I love her book.
Oh, thank you.
I am a middle-aged professional woman. I don't think of her books as any different than any of the other books I read, and I read 3 to 4 a week.
Good for you.
I find that her books have women that are professional and are often middle-aged and are dealing with emotional issues that I have in my own life. and haven't felt the need to classify them as one kind of thing or the other.
Thank you.
I'd also like to ask if she'd like to have coffee sometime, because I think having a conversation with her would be a hoot.
Until I get all angry about Jennifer Egan and start throwing things. Oh, but thank you so much. That's really nice to hear.
Thanks, Leslie. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. I know you're, in fact, during our breaks, you've been, I don't know, have you been Twittering?
I'm tweeting. Even as we speak.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you got some accolades for the quality, the level of tweets.
It was neither of those things. It was my attention to The Bachelor. That Time magazine, they're like, you know, if she's funny about, you know, she's a novelist and she's funny about these issues of gender and chick lit and commercial versus genre. But what you really need to read her for are her tweets about The Bachelor. And I'm like, God, my mom's going to be so proud of me. But I love The Bachelor. I kind of live for it. It is a horrible, cheesy addiction. And I'm telling the world now that I am powerless. And, you know, I can't help it. It's horrible.
You have to go to an ashram or something, and get cleansed.
I think I need a 12-step program. I think, you know, hello, I'm Jennifer and I'm a Bachelor addict. Hi, Jennifer.
Did you watch TV as a kid?
No. No, this is the really fascinating and terribly ironic thing. My dad was a psychiatrist. My mom is a teacher. We were the only TV we were allowed to watch was like half an hour of PBS a day and the very occasional Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. They wanted us to be readers, and we all are, but we're all sort of in the entertainment business. One of my brothers is an entertainment lawyer. The other one's a movie producer. My sister acts. I write TV shows. I know, right? I'm sure.
Forbidden fruit, right?
Forbidden fruit, absolutely. But no, like there wasn't a lot of, and it's terrible because like I have these huge gaps in my knowledge. Like people will be talking about the Brady Bunch or the show with Daisy Duke and the car and the... I'm forgetting it. It's terrible. But there's shows I just never watched, and I don't know about them, and I can't discuss them. And it was hard to be in a writer's room because somebody would make a reference to like, well, they did this on this show or they did it on that show. Dukes of Hazzard.
Dukes of Hazzard. CBS.
I wanted to watch Dukes of Hazzard, and I wasn't allowed to. And you know, it was tough to sort of be in the writer's room, and somebody would be like, well, they did this on the Dick Van Dyke Show or something. And I'd be like, I don't know what that is.
So what's it like in the writer's room?
Filthy.
Well.
Filthy.
And also as a novelist, who I assume essentially works by herself.
By myself, yes. Writers' rooms are hilarious and disgusting. And
hilarious meaning people are really laughing and
really,
being funny.
Really funny. Yes. I mean, it was one of the best times I think I'd ever had in my life, because after basically 10 years of working all alone in coffee shops, like just hoping the baristas would talk to me a little, to be in a room with like smart, funny people who had like the sharpest things to say about everything, it was great. It was like being in the newsroom again, and I had missed it so much. And I loved just, you know, pitching jokes and like, you know, like what zingy thing can we come up with here, or like what is this character going to do, like what is the funniest thing that this person can say. And we had a ball. I really recommend it to anybody. If you can get yourself work in a writer's room, go do it.
So what was the idea, what was the sort of germ that became then State of Georgia, which again premiered in the summer?
State of Georgia was sort of a classic fish out of water story. It was two young girls from a small town in the South who have come to New York City to try to make it. And one of them wants to be an actress, and she's sort of this like exuberantly confident curvy girl who doesn't realize that she's not the ideal and doesn't care when she finds out, thinks that she's going to make it on her terms and change the world instead of letting the world change her. Mm-hmm. And then there's her best friend, who's this sort of like gorgeous but has no idea that she's gorgeous science student who just wants to get her PhD and go like discover new particles and be left alone. You know, the line in the pilot is, it hurts when people look at me. So, you know, two girls, and then the aunt who takes them in and has many ex-husbands and piles of money in this gorgeous Park Avenue apartment. And so a little bit of the fantasy of New York living. Yeah.
And we have Georgia Chamberlain played by?
Raven Simone.
Raven Simone.
Uh-huh. The delightful Raven Simone. She was great. She was, it was amazing to watch people work on camera and to be like sitting. It's called Video Village when you're back there watching the quad split, watching the four. State of Georgia was a multi-camera show, so there's four cameras filming everything, and you're watching what's called the quad split, which is the feed from all four cameras, and sitting there realizing this person does not have a bad angle. Like, there is no shot where she doesn't look adorable. Like, there's no, there is no way to film her. That's, it was kind of a revelation.
And she has a friend named Jo, played by
Mahandra Delfino, who people know from Roswell, who, like, is this sort of Scarlett Johansson dead ringer person. Like, sometimes I would just stare at her. I think she found that weird, but she was so beautiful. And so, like, the thing in Hollywood that you're always looking for is sort of the beautiful girl who can hit the jokes, who can find the funny, and who can do physical comedy, who can sort of do the pratfalls and, like, jump over a bar or, like, hide in a closet or whatever it's going to be, wrestle a bag of chips away from a goat.
Well, this is a scene. Georgia Chamberlain is an aspiring young actress trying to make it in New York, and she's talking with her best friend, Jo, in a yogurt shop.
If they serve yogurt in heaven, I bet you it tastes like that. And it'll be served by a chiseled angel. That is something.
Yeah, it's freezing back there and he's not wearing a jacket.
But it looks like he's working up a sweat, so I'm gonna go sample that.
Oh, no, 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 no. You're not doing this to me again.
Not doing what?
Back home, every time we found a place we liked, you'd always end up liking a guy that worked there and dating him.
Really, Joe? Every time.
Are you forgetting the donut hut? The barbecue hut? Waffle hut?
No, but I did forget how badly people name things back home.
Look at the churches.
Don't you talk about my Jesus hut. So I dated a few guys. What's the problem with that?
That you always break up with him, and for the worst reasons. I didn't like his earlobes. He drove funny. He blinks too much. He doesn't blink enough.
I'm picky. Still don't see the problem.
The problem is that they end up wrecked, and then we can't go anywhere near them or their restaurants. I have lost so much good food. Can I keep the yogurt?
Ladies, some toppings on the house. May I recommend the Fair Trade salted chocolate sauce? We source it from an organic cacao farm in Brazil.
And that's a scene from State of Georgia. You were enjoying yourself, Jennifer Weiner.
I couldn't believe they let us keep Jesus Hut. I kept waiting and waiting and waiting for somebody to say, like, we're going to offend every Christian in the world if we let them call their church the Jesus Hut. And we never got a note on it. I couldn't believe it. I still can't believe it. Jesus Hut.
So what we heard is
my crowning moment.
and I wanted to ask you how much of that is yours, but maybe over time
it's everybody's. It's everybody's. Yeah. Although there was something in there that was mine. Jesus Hut was mine. Oh. Like, Jesus Hut was my joke, and I was very proud of it. But no, but the idea of, like, Jo, who's, like, tiny and skinny, like, our joke was that she eats everything. She's like a goat. Like, she'll eat, like, even things that aren't necessarily meant to be food. And that Georgia keeps dating these guys and then dumping them and depriving her of everything she wants. So that was fun. That's fun to write.
So this was carried over the summer, and I guess you're waiting to hear.
Yeah. You know, the ratings were good but not great, and so they weren't, like, a slam dunk enough for the network to say, like, oh, absolutely, we're going to make more. So we're waiting to hear if they want to make more or not. Yeah, I know. It's fun.
And how does one wait for a decision like
one
that?
One tries to keep busy. One does a lot of yoga. Yeah. You know, I think that I'm working on another book personally. That's how I'm handling it. I like to be busy. I buy houses and write books and do stuff. And
how many houses do you own?
I'm not talking about that. Leave me alone. What are you, my mom? Francis.
And a laugh track. How do you feel about that?
Yeah.
And because we're listening on the radio,
you
really do hear
the
laugh track.
Yes, you do. It's interesting. That's how ABC Family does things. I mean, like, it's a multi-camera sitcom. It's a bit of a throwback. They do laugh tracks with their comedies. That was sort of a non-negotiable. Like, all we could try to do was sort of negotiate the level of laughter. And yeah,
you mean the volume?
The
level?
Volume,
and
yes.
The amount?
Yes. They mix that after you. Like, we shot in front of a live studio audience. So some of what you're hearing is actually, like, people laughing at the show. But yeah, they mix it after. And so you'd sort of be in there with the editors and, like, you know. But I mean, at the end of the day, it's not our say what you're hearing or what you're seeing or any of it. I mean, it's all the network. But for me, like, my mom was at that taping, so I was listening for her laughing. Francis.
Everything comes back to your mom.
I know,
I can
my
see
God,
that.
Right?
I can see that.
Freaky.
There's also a little scene in your novel, Then Came You, where, and I forget who's talking here. Oh, India.
Mm-hmm.
And she just talks about how everyone is so insecure.
Yes.
In L.A.
Yes.
And has that been your experience?
Well, I remember having a really early conversation about, like, actresses when we were auditioning, like way, way back in the day when we were trying to find Georgia. And Jeff Greenstein, who co-created State of Georgia with me, just basically sitting me down and saying, you have to recognize that every single one of them has a monster who lives inside of her called the crazy. Mm. And she might appear normal, but every once in a while, the crazy will come out and you have to feed the crazy.
How do you do that?
Lots of praise, lots of compliments, lots of what you did was brilliant. That was such a smart choice you made in there. That was, people are going to love you.
Even
everyone
if it's not
loves
true.
You already. Yes. Yes. Even if it's not true. I mean, I think that.
Was that hard to do?
Men do it better than I do, I think. Like, that was always an interesting dynamic. Like, Jeff was of the belief that many of them have daddy issues. So if you sent a guy in there to, like, tell them how pretty and smart they were, like, they'd respond better than if it was coming from another woman. It was very interesting. But, I think, like, it's, oh God, this sounds terrible, but it's a little bit like dealing with a 3-year-old. Like, you just tell them how pretty and good they are, and then they brush their teeth. And then they put the cap on the toothpaste. But I'm not saying actresses are like 3-year-olds.
I think you just did.
At least 6. No. Some of them are great. Some of them are crazy. I think it's like anybody else, you know? Some of them are completely professional, right. Completely reliable, learn their lines, give you no grief. Some of them give you grief about very strange things.
Yeah.
Some of them are crazy. But I think the same is probably true of journalists or novelists or engineers or soldiers or like anybody else you'd find. You know, some of them are great. Some of them are crazy.
So do you feel like a success?
Do I feel like a success? Gosh. I think when I wrote my first book, I figured it was going to sell 12 copies and I'd know 6 of the people who bought them. My mom would put it on hold at the library because she doesn't buy hardcovers, and that would be enough. And so, yeah, I mean, the idea that there's like people I don't know who read my books, yes, I feel like a success.
Well, Jennifer Weiner, it's always a pleasure. Thank you
so much
for joining
us great.
Today on Radio Times.
Awesome.
Jennifer Weiner's latest novel called Then Came You. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. Also, thanks to Mike and Scott and Tracy Matisak for filling in while I was away. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. And the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.